Welcome to New Mexico in Focus, the podcast for Monday, October 30th, 2023. I'm Lou DeVizio. This week on the podcast, we're going to talk about the process of prosecuting a police officer for shooting someone on the job and why it so rarely happens here in New Mexico. That's as Attorney General Raul Torres announces just the second criminal case in modern state history. You'll hear two segments that aired in our Friday night broadcast, and I'm also including an extra conversation that didn't make it to the show. That one's focused on solutions, what our expert roundtable believes can be done to keep so many cops from pulling the trigger in the first place. But we'll start with some headlines. A federal indictment accuses former Bernalillo County Sheriff Manny Gonzalez and former Laguna Pueblo Police Chief Rudy Mora of assisting in an illegal gun distribution scheme. Gonzalez and Mora haven't been charged, but according to the indictment, they signed documents authorizing the purchase of more than 1,000 fully automatic weapons the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives classifies as machine guns. Gonzalez and Mora, who worked under him as Bernalillo County Undersheriff, claimed the guns would be used in law enforcement demonstrations, but federal authorities say that that was never their intention. Instead, the two lawmen signed paperwork that allowed Albuquerque gun store owner James Tafoya to illegally buy and then sell those guns. Gonzalez allegedly requested 598 guns between 2015 and 2020, and Mora requested 414 guns from 2020 to 2021. Tafoya is facing charges related to illegally importing guns and making false statements. He's already appeared in a Baltimore court where a federal judge released him pending trial. A North Carolina police chief, a North Dakota police chief, a Florida gun dealer, and a North Carolina YouTuber are also charged in this case. The Georgia O'Keeffe Museum in Santa Fe is starting a $75 million expansion, marking the most expensive privately funded project in the state's cultural history. Donors from across the globe have already contributed over $60 million, which accounts for about 80% of the total cost. A local architect's team will design a 54,000 square foot adobe building with a ground floor and a basement level. This expansion will create more space to showcase, conserve, and store the museum's collection, which includes O'Keeffe's artworks, sketches, photographs, personal items, an archive, and a library. The gallery will triple in size, allowing for an exploration of O'Keeffe's life and her connection to New Mexico. The museum's current buildings will continue to serve as offices and a research center. The museum director tells the Santa Fe New Mexican the project will start by early next year and hopes it will be completed by 2026. Now, to executive producer Jeff Proctor's in-depth roundtable conversation about police shootings in New Mexico. Over the last 10 years, an analysis by Searchlight New Mexico identified 357 people shot by police statewide, more than any other U.S. state per capita during that time period. 211 of those people died, but just two of the cops who pulled the trigger were criminally charged, the Albuquerque officers who gunned down James Boyd, a homeless man with schizophrenia, in 2014. But for just the second time in modern state history, we could see an officer's freedom on the line in a courtroom for an on-duty shooting. Attorney General Raul Torres says he'll charge Las Cruces police officer Brad Lunsford with voluntary manslaughter for an incident last August in which he shot and killed Presley Eze, an unarmed black man accused of stealing a can of beer from a gas station. Torres has laid out his case against Lunsford in an arrest warrant affidavit, but he's still deciding whether to let a judge or a grand jury decide whether there should be a trial. That means there's no formal charge yet, though Torres says he's committed to moving forward. That brings us to the special panel, focused on why police shoot so many people here in New Mexico and why we rarely see criminal charges as a result. Here's Jeff.
Thank you, Lou. Joining me today are journalist Joshua Bowling from Searchlight New Mexico, Leon Howard, a longtime civil rights attorney and deputy director of the American Civil Liberties Union of New Mexico, and retired Metro Court Judge Sharon Walton. Thank you all for being here. So we just heard Lou lay out some of the grim police shooting statistics here in New Mexico, and Albuquerque in particular. Officers shot more people last year than in any other American city besides New York, Los Angeles, and Houston. And those are raw numbers, not rates. But this is a statewide issue in New Mexico, and I would like to begin there. Leon, why do the cops shoot so many people in New Mexico?
There's two ways I would think about that question. One is the big societal issues that plague our beautiful community, and those issues center around homelessness, drug use, and just mental health issues. And so those are big societal issues that contribute to this problem. But when you focus on the other side, there's a culture issue in policing. The DOJ has been here in Albuquerque for 10 years, and we only see statistics staying the same or spiking in terms of police encounters with citizens ending fatally. And so to drill down on a technical aspect of why we have that culture here in New Mexico of shoot first, ask questions later, I have to look at our justifiable homicide statute. It is extremely deferential to police. In my work, I've reviewed a lot of videos where you see police screaming, stop resisting, stop resisting. And even if they're dealing with a docile citizen. And I have to think that goes either to direct training or just officers learning the law in New Mexico. Because if you read the justifiable homicide statute, it allows for deadly force in situations where you're executing an arrest and a citizen's resisting. And so what at our organization we're working really hard on is to create a uniform use of force standard across the country across the state where every police department, whether it's the state police, a small municipality, or a county, are all operating under the same standards. So you're not in a situation where there's confusion for the police or the citizens about where the lines are. Right now, there are standard operating procedures that are different in every department. There's 10th Circuit law, there's United States Supreme Court law, there's state law, and so there's this hodgepodge of laws that make it confusing for officers to know where the lines are, and that could be by design. In a way, it protects the police. And so in terms of this culture issue, when officers know, and when you look at the numbers, that there's just been three officers who have been prosecuted over how long, that tends to go to the culture. And so marrying a uniform use of force standard to our justifiable homicide statute that indicates that if you're outside of this uniform use of force standard, then you can be prosecuted for crossing the line. Right now, society is very frustrated to see these incidents and then see AGs and DAs come to decisions not to prosecute. And playing some from an inside look at the justifiable homicide statute, I can't blame them a lot of times for not charging.
So, Judge Walton, we just heard Leon sort of drill down on policy and legal frameworks. Are there failures at other levels of government that are driving these numbers? What from your perspective, sort of pushes this figure so high every year in New Mexico?
You know, I don't know that you can single out, especially because the Department of Justice has been working with the Albuquerque Police Department and looking at, you know, best practices and reviewing all of their policies and reviewing their training. And at least the Albuquerque Police Department has changed a lot of their approaches. They've rewritten policies, they've changed training, and the use of force training for the state also very much shifted towards de-escalation. And I think we need to recognize that even the Supreme Court law with respect to when police officers can shoot has changed pretty rapidly, you know, from you could shoot any fleeing felon, period, to really being in a much different place now as society changes. And we've changed our expectation of police officers. Their role and what they have to do in our communities has changed so much, so quickly. and we've placed so many demands on them, and we've tried to create new units and new approaches as we see the deficiencies. I remember when I first worked for the police department as a young lawyer, there were a lot of shooting of people experiencing mental health crisis, and the whole CIT approach came into play. And it takes years for those things to really get incorporated, but it looks like that's something people recognize. There's officers with that training. And now today, it seems like most officers have that training instead of just a couple, that every police officer going through an academy gets some. So they recognize those issues. And I think the departments have tried to be responsive, and the government cares. And I agree that there's a police culture. I don't agree that there's a shoot first, ask questions later. But there is a training, and it's a dangerous job. And it is that idea of you need to protect yourself. So if you let down your guard, and there are a lot of stories of when police officers let down their guard and something tragic happens to them. And it's expecting that balance and that momentary decision. So you have to have the recruiting of the best people. And the more policing is vilified and becomes more and more problematic and dangerous, the harder it is to attract people to the job. So it's almost a vicious cycle where we don't have a big pool of people interested in doing the job, and then we're more and more critical of them. At the same time, we're demanding more and more of them. So it's so complicated to try to fix and to say it's just this part, this problem. I think so many agencies have tried to write the magic policy, and legislatures have tried to write the law. We're a violent society for some reason. You know, that's not something you can write a law about or a policy about. When situations are so violent and our city or our state or our country is so violent, we've got to figure out why. What are we doing? You know, we talk a lot about gun violence, but maybe we need to take a step back from that and talk about violence. Why have we embraced being so violent and aggressive? And, you know, if a police officer is responding to a situation, it takes a special skill to de-escalate, and not everybody has it every day. And we send them into these situations. I often think about that horrible domestic violence call that ended up, that it was a dismembered child set on fire. How can you expect a police officer who responds to something like that to be okay? And the things that they see and the things that they're subject to, it causes that us and them, and the euphemisms of responding to and neutralizing a threat instead of
responding in a more human fashion.
Right.
So behavioral health services for police officers would be one way to sort of think about this.
But we've done that.
Us to move on just a little bit. I'm sorry to cut you
You're
short.
You're good.
I want to talk a little bit about what happens after a police officer shoots somebody. Obviously, what immediately takes place is a couple of different investigations start. And Joshua, I'm going to ask you to respond to this question. On one side, you've got like an internal affairs investigator who's looking for policy violations. The stakes there, obviously, are that the officer could lose his job, be suspended, something like that. On the other side, you've got a criminal investigation. The stakes there are obviously much higher. You're talking about the potential of the officer's freedom. What have you learned through the course of your reporting, in particular, about the way that criminal investigation takes place? Who does it? How does it happen?
Right. Across the state, broadly, state police handles that. Now, when we're here in Bernalillo County or down in Doñana County, we have what's called a multi-agency task force. And critics say that's really a misnomer because we have a coalition of, if APD, for example, fatally shoots someone, you have the multi-agency task force convene, and it's going to be made up of several different law enforcement agencies in the area, including the Bernalillo County Sheriff's Office. The big asterisk that is in bold and italicized next to that is that the agency who committed the shooting gets to lead the investigation. So critics say that's really, you know, the fox guarding the hen house. In what world does that make sense that you shoot someone and then you get to lead the investigation? Adding on to that, something that I've tried to really emphasize in my reporting is the fact that when this is referred to a district attorney's office or the attorney general's office for potential prosecution, they do not do an original investigation. They do not go interview people. They do not subpoena people. They review the documents and the body cam that the multi-agency task force or the state police, if you're outside of the metro area, has compiled. Can we trust that information? Can we trust the quality of that investigation if it's police who put it together themselves?
sort of creates the potential for garbage in, garbage out. If you get a bad investigation and you're a prosecutor, you're left with a difficult decision based on kind of an incomplete case file.
And these are extremely difficult cases to prosecute. We have the history of James Boyd to show that. I think it's fascinating that A.G. Torres, with the Las Cruces case, is not going for a murder charge. We're going for voluntary manslaughter. We're going for what appears to be a very slightly lower bar here than a murder charge. One thing that I want to push back on, too, that I've heard a lot from these police departments as I've reported this out this year especially, I have really agonized over, we've made a huge multi-million dollar commitment to mental health resources in Albuquerque and across the state. We have civilian first responders who will go to the site of a mental health crisis. Why are police shootings still on the rise? And I've had this conversation with APD. I've had this conversation with District Attorney Bregman. And the answer I always get from them is, it's simple, Joshua. Homicides are on the rise. Well, that kind of implies that police are coming up to the scene of a homicide in progress, seeing the bad guy try to kill somebody and discharging their weapon on the scene. So I've poured through APD documents, and I'll tell you how many times that happened last year. It happened once. And the officer—
Out of 19 shootings.
Yes, and the officer missed the man he was shooting at. So we can't attribute one of our fatal shootings to that statistic.
Gotcha.
But I would like to respond to that. I don't think that's what he means, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I think it is that idea of people reacting violently and aggressively and the lack of trust and faith in police departments, because hearing your concern is that somehow, and you know, I understand why, we've lost faith in our institutions that we used to trust and we used to believe. So if we believed that police officers were acting with integrity and investigating things, and then you would trust that investigation. But we're starting now from the premise of, if you're investigating yourself, you're automatically suspicious. And I understand that, because there's the idea of protecting each other, thin blue line, things that we've heard all about. But we don't have that same trust and respect for law enforcement that things are going to go well, because we've seen too often that things don't go well.
I want to talk about one of the things that may have changed that, and Leanne, I'll ask you to respond to this last question for the segment. How has body camera and citizen video changed the perception of this? The Azay shooting being a really good example of that. Two body cam views, a citizen's recording of that. How has that changed things, in particular in a case like that, where it's an unarmed black man being shot?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. The having video available, of course, in a lot of instances is the best possible evidence you can have, and it makes it more real to citizens viewing that to make the threshold decisions to say that is not okay. We all grow up and want to feel safe, and so when there's not video evidence and you have the officer's word versus, you know, civilian witnesses, we want to believe the police. And so a lot of those barriers have been broken down, and we see how these situations can escalate. It's helpful to have that. Now, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention APD's investigations and the lack of trust that has come from that, because there is a case here in a police shooting where some of the video footage was found to be missing, manipulated, a lot of times through public records. Things get lost and you have to sue the department, like pulling teeth to get that type of evidence. And so all of that erodes trust. And when you mention the impact of seeing the videos and the impact that that has on community of colors, it can't be underestimated. When you're a kid growing up in our society and you keep seeing unarmed black people across the country being shot and killed by the police, that takes an emotional, it puts emotional weight on our communities, and it does erode the trust. It gives you a lack of faith in the system, and it's incredibly heartbreaking for parents to have those discussions with their children, because at the end of the day, when I talk to people in the Black community, it's not that we don't want police. We want law enforcement that works for us the same way it works across the board for other communities.
We could spend the rest of the day talking about this one, but we're going to have to leave this segment here. I appreciate everyone's thoughts. Let's get back to police shootings and focus in on the prosecutor's role. There's been an endless parade of alternative systems. What's remained the same is that the process is different from jurisdiction to jurisdiction around the state. They've all produced the same result, almost no prosecutions in police shooting cases. All of this obviously is sort of an effort to do away with the perceived conflict of interest that local DAs have in terms of trying to decide whether to charge a police officer in a shooting. Judge Walton, let's start with you. Is that a real or perceived conflict of interest? A DA being asked to make a charging decision regarding a department they rely on every day to make their cases in court, is that a real conflict or just something we all think is a conflict?
Well, you think about who are their witnesses in their cases. It's the police department. And when you damage your credibility or relationship with that department, you damage your ability to work on cases going forward. So it's obviously a real conflict that exists. It's how you handle it. And, you know, there are ways to segregate portions of your agency out, you know, have special DAs that handle certain things that don't regularly use those same officers. But they develop relationships. They're considered a team. I mean, New Mexico has the team concept. The prosecutor and the police officer are a team for purposes of criminal cases. So if you're on the same team, it's not just a perceived conflict. It's a conflict that actually exists and that they're mindful of.
Joshua, I want to ask a little bit about that sort of patchwork, that hodgepodge. You mentioned that a little bit in the previous segment regarding the investigative part. But when it comes to the review, the decision that gets made on whether a charge should go forward, it's done differently in almost every district around the state. What have you seen in your reporting in terms of the kinds of challenges that presents for the rest of the legal system?
Absolutely. There are 14 different district attorney's offices in this state. Virtually every single one of them has a different process to handle this, which makes comparing and contrasting, frankly, a nightmare when you're looking at a police shooting that happens in Albuquerque versus Las Cruces versus Santa Fe versus Chavez County. One district attorney's office, for example, that is over Sandoval County, they just do not review police shooting cases at all because they believe that would be a conflict of interest for their office. Others, like the Bernalillo County District Attorney's Office, will hire special prosecutors who are not staffers per se to review these cases, but it's also a small pool of attorneys who handle those sorts of things, and they know the police officers, they know the district attorney's office in and out very well. So it's a complete checkerboard depending on where you go in the state how this is handled.
Leon, lawmakers have tried to tackle this. There have been a lot of proposals to potentially consolidate a one-stop shop that would investigate and review the police shooting for possible prosecution, do that in the AG's office. That's a proposal we've seen a bunch of times. That hasn't gone anywhere. Kind of similar to a lot of the other measures that we've seen in Santa Fe directed at or related to the issue of police shootings. What has it been like in the Roundhouse over the course of the past several sessions in terms of trying to address this issue?
Yeah, so I think that clearly, advocates, lawmakers, for a very long time have been pushing for uniformity around this issue. You can really get into the politics of it all, but at the end of the day, what we just described is different processes all around the state and streamlining that process, irrespective of where it's housed, having an independent agency investigating and making these decisions is going to help reinstill some of that trust in the community that we've all talked about that's been lost. And then again, further education on how the system works so community understands that and the technical aspects of the law and knowledge around the justifiable homicide statute, because all the community hears is a decision not to pros- prosecute, and there's just a lack of understanding about the why. And when people know the why, you can start making some changes in the law.
I'm going to ask you in just a second to talk some about some of the successes when it comes to police violence legislatively in the last handful of years. I don't want us to spend a ton of time on the history of the way police shootings got reviewed, but there is a lot of history. I spent a lot of time writing about this. There have been a lot of different things that have been tried here. In terms of the framework, the system that we've got now, education sounds like a great idea where people would understand better. Do you feel like any of the systems, whether it's a hodgepodge or one in particular, has taken a step toward transparency and at least trying to educate the public a little bit on how these decisions get made?
Not specifically in the realm of investigating police shootings, but there were some strides that were made in terms of getting more uniform standards in our state around how police use force. We banned chokeholds, which is a big step, of course, after what we saw with George Floyd. We banned shooting at or in a moving motor vehicle as a mechanism law enforcement can use. And so there are strides being made in the realm of standardizing police use of force in our state, but we still have a long way to go, particularly around creating uniform requirements for de-escalation. It's one thing to have a policy, but where we see the gap is enforcement of those policies and meaningful measures in the law to hold police accountable who run afoul of those standards.
Let's take a hypothetical scenario, and Judge Walton, I'll ask you about this, in which a prosecutor, a special prosecutor, a team of prosecutors, whatever the mechanism happens to be, decides that it is time to go forward. I see a case that I think needs prosecuted. Regardless of who's doing the investigating and who's doing the prosecuting, there really seem to be two paths. One is to present the case to a grand jury. The other is to present the case in a preliminary hearing. Can you tell viewers what the difference between those two processes is?
Sure. A grand jury proceeding is where a group of citizens are selected and serve as grand jurors for a variety of reasons. Sometimes there's a special grand jury, but usually we have grand juries that sit for a period of time and they hear all of the cases that that DA wants to prosecute. In that setting, it's secret. And so the citizens are making the decision, but the proceedings and their deliberations and what they're presented with remain secret. And the district attorney really runs the show. There's not a judge. The defendant has the right to appear before them and can bring an attorney, but the attorney can't really do anything during the proceeding. And there is no cross-examination of witness. So basically, they present their investigation, for example, and then the citizen grand jurors make a decision whether or not to prosecute. That was long favored because then you have regular folks in our communities making these decisions. And then in the recent years, there's been a real criticism about that, partially because of the lack of transparency and the belief that citizens just rely too much on the DAs, and whatever the DA wants, they generally go along with. And that
the
DA
old ham sandwich thing, right?
Right. So then there's been this shift, and in Bernalillo County, it happened last 5-6 years, where almost everything goes to preliminary hearing. And in preliminary hearings, New Mexico has some pretty strict rules for preliminary hearings with respect to the level of proof and the type of evidence, and the rules of evidence apply. So the same kind of standards that would apply at trial apply for a prelim, which makes them more difficult. But the witnesses appear, and a judge makes the decision based on what's presented, whether there's probable cause. And to bind the person over on charges. Probable cause is a really low standard. People think it means probably, like more likely than not. It does not. It's a much lower standard than that. And it is there a reasonable probability to reasonably believe that the law has been violated? It doesn't mean, is there any other explanation here? It's just, is there a reasonable probability that this is criminal behavior and the case should be bound over? And in those instances, they're open proceedings. The witnesses come in, they're sworn in, both sides get to question them, And their testimony becomes part of the record of the case, and it can be used in all the subsequent proceedings. So the downside to that is if you're very early in a case, you're starting to get locked in, and somebody might be doing more investigating, and then that testimony can be manipulated. And so it makes it harder sometimes for prosecutors to do too much too soon, because it can follow the case, and that testimony that's given is something that can be used. And I think, you know, you have some of the best attorneys representing, and they're able to creatively use those proceedings to their advantage. So it's more transparent, it's more formal, you have a judge making the decision, but it happens so early in the process that sometimes it's dangerous.
Thank you for explaining that. We've tried that at this table before. It didn't go nearly that well. I want to go around the table for my last question today. So AG Torres has not said yet, and I'd like to circle back to the Eze shooting from Las Cruces. The Attorney General has not said yet whether he plans to go to a preliminary hearing or present the case to a grand jury. But either way, there are going to be a lot of eyes on this case. New Mexico has led the nation for police shootings for a lot of years. We've spent a bunch of time at the table talking about that already. Joshua, let's start with you. What are the stakes in terms of public perception around police violence for this case?
It's really difficult to overstate what a watershed moment this could be. My reporting in September pointed to two prosecutions in the last decade for police shootings across the state. We had more than 350 police shootings in that time, 200 of which at least were fatal. That's likely an undercount. This is a big issue in New Mexico. We talk often about the way that we, per capita, lead the nation in police shootings. But like you said earlier, up here in Albuquerque, only Los Angeles, New York, and Houston shot more people last year. Well, those are all cities that dwarf Albuquerque in size. And this is becoming a growing issue across the state, in Santa Fe and in Las Cruces and in Rio Rancho. We're seeing similar trends play out, just on a smaller level for now. So it's really difficult to overstate how far this could go, depending on the result of the trial, on how likely this sort of thing is to happen more in the future.
Leon, the last time we saw one of these cases inside a criminal courtroom was the James Boyd shooting. That case, of course, ended in a hung jury, which I think was unsatisfying for people who believe lots of different ways in this town. Statewide, what are the stakes? What happens after this case is finished?
You know, for the impact on communities of color, a lot of people grapple with the issue of, do we celebrate when an officer's charged? Is it this, you know, we see the system working for other people, so this is a moment that we can see the system also work for us. But there's deeper conversations around restorative justice and a discord in celebrating the prosecution and potential jail time of anybody, because it upholds those systems. And we know that just one instance of a cop being prosecuted and going to jail isn't going to change the disparate impact of the carceral system on people of color. It's not going to change the disparate impact of policing on people of color. So I don't have a clean answer to that.
I don't think it's a clean question. Yeah. Judge Walton, I'll ask you, could this case potentially have ramifications or make change in the legal system more broadly, depending on how it turns out?
I doubt it. I don't see that there's anything particular about this case I think it has that would change the legal system. But with respect to the approach of district attorney's offices or the AG's office and the willingness to bring cases, you know, it'll be interesting to see what a jury does and what a jury decides. And I think the fact is, very rarely does a conviction bring kind of the closure, the satisfaction, or the resolution that we think. Even in just a murder case, it doesn't bring that person back, and it doesn't fix whatever was wrong. And we do a lot of discipline and reviews on an administrative side to try to fix problems and to change behavior and to send those messages to fellow police officers. But there's no transparency, that because of the nature of personnel actions, the public never hears about those and they never see them. So even though there's very few criminal prosecutions, there is a lot of administrative investigation, administrative actions that are taken by agencies and police officers who lose their jobs. And that's not something the public hears about very often. To really have the idea that police departments are taking things seriously, they are trying to make changes, and they are indeed making changes and reviewing each other. The Albuquerque Police Department has put a significant shift into how many people review these cases, what they have to do. They have a judge overseeing to make sure that they're doing things right in addition to what the Department of Justice has done. So there are changes. I just don't know that the criminal approach is where the change is what's going to lead the change. I think it's more these other things that are in place that will really drive the change within police departments.
Speaking of things that are potentially unsatisfying, the secrecy around administrative discipline in police departments, we could spend a whole other segment on that another time. Okay, so we spent a lot of time on this week's episode of New Mexico in Focus talking about the vexing issue of criminal accountability for police officers whose on-duty conduct goes beyond a policy violation. So we wanted to explore some solutions for an online-only segment, especially because of who is at the table with me this week. Searchlight New Mexico investigative reporter Joshua Bowling, a longtime civil rights attorney and deputy director of the ACLU of New Mexico, Leon Howard, and retired Metro Court Judge Sharon Walton. So, all right, everybody, here is a quote from AG Raul Torres at his news conference announcing voluntary manslaughter charges against Las Cruces police officer Brad Lunsford in the fatal shooting of Presley Azay. Here's the quote. "We need to start having a broader, more complicated conversation on why this keeps happening in this country. Regardless of the outcome of this prosecution, we have a much broader task in front of us in this community and all across the country. This was a tragedy that never should have happened. I want everyone to understand that when Azay lost his life on the pavement outside that gas station, the original call that came in was for petty theft." So let's try a version of that more complicated conversation here at this table. Judge Walton, what needs to happen so that the police shoot fewer people in New Mexico?
You know, if I had the answer to that, I would have shared it long before. It is a really complicated question. And in preparing for all of this today, I tried to do a lot of research. And I found one study that really looked at multiple officers being at the scene and some made the decision to shoot and others not, and to look at the difference between them. And I think that's a novel approach. And I think it's something we need to look at, because some of the things that we've blamed or cited, research doesn't seem to support that that is the cause or that is the problem. So I think it's maybe letting go of those preconceived notions that we have about what's driving this and what's causing it, and really try to do some step back and look at some of those more fundamental things, and be willing to let go of our firmly held belief about what's wrong and what needs to be changed. Because agencies that have made those changes and have done those things are experiencing more shootings, not less. So it is more complicated and we don't have it figured out. And I think we need to take a step back and start over again with our research to really look at it and try to find what is causing this. And it obviously is a response by a police officer, but so much more happens before that. So you can't usually ever fix one side of a problem. You have to fix both sides. And I think we focus on one side and then we focus on the other. And we, you know, that holistic response that you always need, I think that's where we need to look.
What do you think some of those dry holes or fruitless things that have been changed in a lot of police departments in America, what are some examples of that, like those areas of research or focus that haven't gotten us anywhere?
The diversity of the police forces was one. I absolutely thought that, you know, mirroring the community with and having people that came from different walks of life was going to change this. And the research that I was reading preparing for this was suggesting that those folks were involved in more shootings, not less, which shocked me. That's not what I was expecting to read. you know, a lot of the preconceived notions I had about what contributes, and when I went to read to prepare for this, I was surprised that they didn't seem to help. Obviously, education and training and working with the community is always a good thing, but that one hit me. And one that I would have never occurred to me that the study I was telling you about was officers that are involved in misdemeanors for the most of their day and most of their work tended to be less likely to be involved in shootings than those who deal with felonies and violence more. And they would de-escalate more than those who are habitually exposed to the more dangerous and violent situations. That seems like such common sense but that's the only study I found that had identified that as a factor to look at and changing the way maybe officers are assigned and how they respond to calls and things like that might be a different approach that we could take. That's not something I'd ever heard before I read that study.
And that cultural aspect that the judge mentioned is very important to the conversation. The training and diversity issues within police forces is a big topic, but like so many issues, going to the root and the history of law enforcement itself in our country has to be examined. You know, there's a direct line from police forces to slave patrols. And so when you have that root, that foundation of a system that is designed to target people of color, it's not surprising that when you pluck people of color into those systems, you're still producing the same result. There's a culture issue in policing, and especially here in New Mexico, shoot first, ask questions later. And from my experience on the side of litigating civil rights cases and hearing officers talk among each other, there's a tendency to dehumanize people from different backgrounds. And so when you start viewing people as not human that you're encountering with, it's not a surprise that you're, when you're making split-second decisions, you're more prone to pull the trigger when you don't share characteristics with the person you're dealing with.
So what is the thing that we are not talking about or not focused on backing up before that police officer's finger is on the trigger and pulling it? What is the big idea that we haven't tried in New Mexico yet to try to do something about those nation-leading statistics every year?
We rely on our police to do too much. We need our police. They're trained to fight crime. And so there's a common theme of all of society's ails. When lawmakers are uncomfortable, when society is uncomfortable with something, we end up making it illegal. And then it becomes the police's problem. We rely on our police officers to be homelessness coordinators. We rely on our police officers to be mental health crisis intervention specialists. We rely on our police officers to be addiction experts. And the reality is those issues should be either working with experts in those fields in conjunction with our police officers, or wholly reimagining policing and what the appropriate circumstances are for police to respond to issues and where the intervention points are and when we can have emergency responders who are trained to deal with smaller issues. My heart goes out to the family in the Presley-Izay situation. That was a misdemeanor encounter.
He's accused of stealing a beer.
That's right. And so, as we talked about earlier, the law in New Mexico under justifiable homicide is very, very deferential to police. Where there is some indication that force, especially deadly force, is frowned upon even with deferential laws, is when you're encountering somebody who's suspected of a misdemeanor. And that's where the concept of de-escalation really comes in. There's so many times I've reviewed encounters through lapel cameras where you have an officer responding to a situation, and instead of taking measures to play a peacekeeper, they continually escalate the situation. And New Mexicans have to feel safe that when you call the police out to an encounter, when you're calling for help, that they're not going to come there and make things worse.
To that point,
No, please. I was going to say there is no one big idea. It sounds like from your perspective there are a bunch. So yeah, I'll kick it to you, Joshua, to finish up. What has come up in your reporting in terms of solutions to this thing that we all keep talking about every year?
Right. I've spent a lot of time across the Western U.S. with Denver, Albuquerque, Las Cruces, places where we've started down this road of creating some sort of public safety department that is not police to handle these very calls. Homelessness, mental health crises, things like that. Here in Albuquerque, we've had Albuquerque Community Safety for about 3 years. It was announced within days of APD shooting and killing Max Mitnick in his home, who of course was suffering a mental health crisis and needed someone who was trained in mental health issues. We've had that department for 3 years now. In the time that we've had that department, police shootings in this city have only increased. Fatal police shootings have only increased. And the common theme that I keep coming back to in my reporting when I speak with responders on these teams, experts around the country, is that no matter how many millions of dollars we sink into these departments, and we do, here in Albuquerque, we've made a huge commitment to ACS. Our dispatchers are still sending police officers to many of these calls because they can't break the old habit that, well, if it's a mental health crisis, that could be dangerous. Maybe we need a police officer there, even if the person is unarmed, even if the person doesn't have a criminal history. And that, to me, seems to be the biggest issue we've seen come out of my reporting.
Is that a training or policy issue? Is that a matter of, obviously, the State Department of Public Safety is the entity that certifies dispatchers and also police officers. Is that what that is? Is there a statutory change that needs to happen? Is there a bigger conversation that we're not having that looks like maybe the dispatch might be a spot where we could look to change something?
Absolutely. Early in this year, I spent a lot of time with Elaine Maestas, whose sister Alicia Lucero was killed by BCSO deputies years ago. She took a job with ACS as a first responder. She was going to these calls. And the number one thing she told me over and over again was, no matter how hard we fight for this department, the police are still being sent out. Dispatch will not stop sending armed police officers to the scene of nonviolent calls. And I think that opens up another can of worms when we're looking at Presley Eze in Las Cruces. Sure, Las Cruces has Project Light. It is their, you know, nonviolent response team made up of a firefighter, paramedic, and a mental health professional. Even if it was operational when Brad Lunsford shot him in the parking lot of that gas station, would they have been sent? This was over petty theft, so police ultimately still would have been called at the end of the day. And I think that really, really bears looking into.
I appreciate all three of you spending a minute to explore some of the solutions after what was a difficult conversation about the problem. Thanks so much.
Thanks to Jeff and our panelists for those conversations. And of course, thank you for listening to the podcast this week. And if you missed our show, I really want to push you towards the Our Land or New Mexico in Focus YouTube pages, where Laura Paskus and our production team have put together one of the most beautiful segments I've ever seen on our air. It's really a love letter of sorts to our state's last wild river, the Gila, and it asks us to consider what lessons the Upper Gila River holds for the future of our entire environment and the rest of the Colorado River Basin more specifically. Every shot in this piece is breathtaking, and some of the wildlife footage will just melt your heart. And again, to the Our Land crew, just an absolutely great job. And you can watch that on the Our Land or New Mexico in Focus YouTube channels. I've also linked it in the description of this podcast. Anyways, thanks for listening this week, guys. Be sure to follow our Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube pages through the week. You can give us feedback or just stay up to date as we post previews and news items leading up to our show on Friday night. Thanks again, everyone. I'm Senior Producer Lou DeVizio for Monday, October 30th, 2023. This is New Mexico in Focus, the podcast. Have a great week, everyone.